We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This is Focus. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producer, Harriet Williamson, at the controls this hour, Jason Croft. Kyle Mabry was on Hour 1. This year, our program turns 30, and we're marking the occasion by listening back to some of the oldest interviews that we have in our tape archives. We went looking for guests and topics that are as important today, in some cases as controversial, as they were when we first aired these shows. And the theme that ties together both of the interviews in this installment of the Deep Archives Project is public health and the way that politics can sometimes derail efforts to respond to public health problems. Certainly, one of the biggest challenges to public health to come along in the past 30 years has been AIDS. The first really important mass-market book about AIDS and the AIDS crisis was published in 1987. That book was And the Band Played On, Politics, People, and the AIDS Epidemic by Randy Schiltz. He made a specialty of writing about gay issues, and he was the first openly gay writer to work for a major metropolitan newspaper. We talked on this program about the book And the Band Played On in December of 1987. His main argument was that in the early years of the epidemic, AIDS did not get the attention it deserved because it was seen almost exclusively as a disease of gay men.
And it's what's interesting is that I don't believe anybody ever sat down and verbalized that. But you can see in each institution that I talk about in my book, whether it's the government, whether it's the scientific medical establishment, whether it's local public health, that the fact that that it was gay men who were largely affected early on and later intravenous drug users, that it was people like this who were getting this disease, that it would be because of who it struck, these institutions did not mobilize in a way in which I think they clearly would have had this hit a more respectable group of people.
Yeah, I'm thinking of one doctor that is quoted early on in the book, and this was the doctor who was trying to get the New England Journal of Medicine to print an article.
Yeah.
About the fact that this was in the very early stages and that there were a suspicious number of cases of gay men who were coming up with a very rare form of pneumonia. And at the journal, he asked them, well, how long is it going to take to get this published? And in a very leisurely manner, they said, well, if everything goes well, maybe 3 months.
No, 6 months.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, six months. That's even worse, 6 months. And his comment was, I guess maybe he made it to himself or maybe he made it to you. You don't do business as usual in an emergency, and this was an emergency, but as time went along, there was still too many people doing business as usual.
Yeah, that's the theme of the book, really, that for example, when you mentioned the lag time and trying to get information published, well, that's the way it always works. What is unusual is that you have a deadly new infectious disease that's working its way through the population.
Yeah.
And it was, if I were going to do any other title than one I did, it would have been business as usual, because that's how it was, the mode that just about everybody took in dealing with this epidemic, and they used ordinary measures in an extraordinary situation.
Mm-hmm. Just, out of curiosity, one of the things that you talk about in the book is that for such a long time, it was very difficult to get the media interested in writing about AIDS.
Yeah.
Did you have any difficulty finding someone to publish this?
It was interesting. Early when we launched on this 2 years ago, by then I was already pretty well recognized around the country as the reporter who'd done more work on this than anybody, and we thought it'd be pretty easy to get a publisher. Well, it turned out that there was only one publisher interested in doing this, that there were some gay editors of publishing houses in New York, but they objected to some of the gay politics in the book, where they felt it was too critical of gay political leaders. And then the heterosexual editors didn't think AIDS was going to be important enough to warrant a whole book, so they just weren't interested in it at all.
Well, I'd like to talk a little bit about, have you talk about the way that the various institutions that you talk about in the book responded to AIDS, and I suppose a good place as any is to talk about the way that medicine responded. It seems that in the early stages, the people who were most interested and were putting the most energy into trying to understand what was going on were the people at the Centers for Disease Control, in Atlanta, and it seems sort of distressing, and it certainly seemed frustrating to them. They were faced, on the one hand, with what they thought was a serious problem and not enough money to do anything about it, and that when then they tried to get other major federal health institutions involved, things like the National Cancer Institute or the National Institutes of Health, they just couldn't seem to get them interested, either that or it seemed that what they were doing was rather half-hearted or misguided.
Well, here I think we have to go straight into talking about the Reagan administration. That early on, the researchers at the Centers for Disease Control realized that we had literally a catastrophe in the making. They wanted to work on this. They wanted to launch the studies to understand this disease and then try to solve some of its mysteries, which at that time were vast. But again and again, the administration turned a deaf ear on their pleas for money. Now, first of all, I think some of the episodes you're alluding to are the administration health officials would say, well, go get money from the National Institutes of Health. And the National Institutes of Health would say, well, we're not interested in it. They just didn't even answer the memos. They couldn't be troubled with it. But I think that scenario reflects, I think, the political problems you had in Washington. They shouldn't have had to go begging to other agencies to try to get money. And if they were told by health officials to go begging, the health officials should have made sure they got the money rather than just ignoring the situation. And, I mean, this is the whole story of the early years of AIDS. As the situation gets increasingly serious, and you can some of these memos that I got through the Freedom of Information Act that I reveal in my book are prophetic. At one point, you had the person who is in charge of AIDS at the CDC write flat out that the lack of resources at the Centers for Disease Control had deepened the invasion of this virus into the American population. What was so ironic was that he wrote that memo on April 12, 1983, and that very same day, Health and Human Services Secretary Margaret Heckler was on Capitol Hill telling congressmen who were very suspicious about the lack of speed in the administration's response. She was telling congressmen that very day that, well, she had talked to the people at the Centers for Disease Control, and they told her that no stone was being left unturned. They didn't need another penny. And I think it's in this sort of web of deceit on the part of the administration that you really see the extent of the AIDS tragedy, and that it gets to the premise of the book that AIDS didn't just happen, it was allowed to happen.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you look at the choices the administration did make, what they did or didn't do, how are we to understand that? Was it in fact a case simply of looking at the dollars involved, or was there more to it than that?
It was that mundane. It was honestly that mundane for the first couple of years. It gets more heinous, I think, later on. But in the first couple of years, it was you've got to remember, this administration was elected with one priority above all else, which was to cut domestic spending. And if something was not arms spending, they just weren't interested in funding it. And so the whole psychology at all of the domestic agencies, such as the Department of Health and Human Services, was we just can't spend anything for it. If this was an ordinary situation, maybe we could stand that. But when we're talking about agencies like the Centers for Disease Control, which is our front line against new phenomena like epidemics, that meant that they didn't have the resources to fight this epidemic when it happened.
Mm-hmm. Something else that's a little bit disturbing is the reaction of a lot of researchers in the medical community who apparently looked at the disease and somehow felt that it wasn't important enough or it wasn't career enhancing enough for them to want to be involved. That their decisions about what research was that they wanted to get involved in and what research should be done seemed so driven by. Again, something as mundane as, you know, am I going to discover something as significant that's going to make my name in the history of medicine?
Well, that was so interesting. If you watch the TV shows that have AIDS researchers on them, you'll notice they're all almost very young. And the reason is because the only people who were willing to work on AIDS in the early years were people who were very young. I mean, largely, there are some exceptions. And people who didn't already have a career established. Because virtually everybody who worked in AIDS in the first few years were advised by their senior doctors, don't work in this, it's a homosexual disease. They were said things like, get your career back on a legitimate track of research. And virtually everybody who worked on AIDS, and this was not only in the United States but in France, had to put their careers on the line in order to study this disease. And it was once, it's so funny now, is that now, of course, there's lots of money going in. And see, back then, too, because the government wasn't funding any research, because it was impossible to get grants, that again had a role of making it a very unfashionable area of study. And the, of course, now there's lots of fame, there's lots of glory, and there's lots of money. So you've got, you know, lots of people very interested in studying it. But that wasn't the case back in 81 through 84, 85.
Mm-hmm. And it also seems that what's ironic is that in the beginning stages, people were hesitant to get involved because they felt that their, you know, perhaps wasn't enough prestige there, or the grants weren't there. But as time develops and people did seem to wake up to the fact that it was important, then researchers seemed willfully to get in each other's way. I mean, then when it seemed that there was something important here to be discovered, there was certainly not the kind of collegial atmosphere you would hope for in a case like this.
That was probably the most disappointing aspect of what I found while doing the research for the book. You've got to remember, back in January 1983, back when we were all writing, when, you know, I as a journalist was writing story on the story after story about this mystery disease, and using my thesaurus to find new synonyms for baffling and mysterious, that the French at the researchers at the Pasteur Institute had discovered the virus that caused AIDS. And at first, of course, they couldn't assert, they knew it was linked to AIDS, but they couldn't assert that it was the cause. But within 6 or 7 months, they could. And then, but the researchers at the National Cancer Institute were very jealous of the idea that anybody else might discover the cause of AIDS and they wouldn't get credit. They largely deprecated the French research, and the American research establishment simply wouldn't pay any attention to it until April of 1984, which was a year and 3 months after the French discovery. Secretary of Health and Human Services Heckler had this massive press conference and announced with great patriotic pride that American research had sought the target and hit the mark, and that American research had discovered the cause of AIDS. And when all the American researchers at the National Cancer Institute had done was get the same virus the French had, give it their own name, and then claim it as their own discovery. That doesn't end the scientific politicking. That only began it. Because by that point, you had the Centers for Disease Control had realized the French did have the cause of AIDS, and they'd started collaborative studies. Well, the National Cancer Institute was incredibly jealous and very angry that the Pasteur Institute might get credit for discovering the cause of AIDS, so they wouldn't cooperate with the Centers for Disease Control. Think of this. You had the two lead health institutions in the federal government, both, you know, at the forefront of fighting AIDS, weren't cooperating with each other because one agency was afraid the other might give somebody else credit for discovering the cause of AIDS. That happened for a year. To some extent, scientists all over the world had to choose sides. Were they going to be on the side of the French, which is where the moral right was, because everybody knew the French had discovered the cause of AIDS first, or would they be on the side of the National Cancer Institute? The problem there is the National Cancer Institute is one of the most lavishly funded scientific groups in the world, and they give out more grants than just about anybody in the world. And if you sided against the NCI, that hurt your chances of getting grant money. And yet this is what had to happen. And so while scientists were fighting over prestige and who was going to get credit for discovering the cause of AIDS, that I think they were losing sight of what the true enemy was in all this, and the true enemy was the disease.
In looking back with the benefit of hindsight, it's easy to see that there were warning signs all over that people should have been able to read, and obviously because you document the concern of many medical people, some people were in fact reading them. But is it fair to say that somehow we should have known sooner? I mean, were the signs really so clear?
Yeah.
Or they were?
At different stages. I think in the I deal with the problem from 80 to 85, largely. That's the focus of my book. And I think, say, for the first year of the epidemic, you can give people leeway in terms of not responding quickly. because it wasn't really clear that it was an infectious disease, and it was, and there were so many mysteries about it. So there, I think that there is a period of time in which you can say, well, you know, how are we to know? I think that we reach a period of time, though, very quickly where we did know. And it was the reason that the warning signs were not heeded was because people did not want to pay attention to them. And this gets to the failure of a central institution which allowed all the other institutions to fail, and that's the news media. That most of us weren't paying attention to AIDS when so much of the framework for this disaster was being laid because the news media didn't cover it. That the news media was not interested in a disease that affected homosexuals, this gay cancer, as it was so ignominiously called in early headlines. And by not covering AIDS, that allowed the federal government and other institutions to deal with the problem and to not deal with the problem as they saw fit. And that usually meant not dealing with the problem. And because I think that it's pretty clear that the warning signals are there. And people like the CDC were dying to get the word out. They were dying for media coverage, and the reporters just weren't interested.
Mm-hmm. And again, you think that here the bottom line is that they saw primarily that it was gay men who were affected, and they felt uncomfortable in writing about that?
Well, the news media is the most brazenly, the prejudice plays the most brazen role. Where then it was just overtly discussed. Where in most of these other institutions, it wasn't. I mean, you have to look at the network of how all of these institutions failed. Think about it. I mean, you had the federal government viewed AIDS as a budget problem. Local public health very often dealt with AIDS as a political problem. The scientific establishment dealt with AIDS as a problem of prestige. Wasn't going to enhance their prestige to work on it. The gay community very often dealt with AIDS as a public relations problem, and the media dealt with AIDS as a homosexual problem that wasn't going to interest anybody else. So while all of this was going on, very few people were dealing with AIDS for what it was, which was a profound medical problem and a threat to the public health.
I'd like to talk a little bit about something else that you talk about in the book, and that is the way that the gay community has responded over time to the AIDS epidemic.
I think early on there was a first denial, and then there was a tendency to frame AIDS issues in a political context. In San Francisco, we had a very dramatic debate over closing of the bathhouses, and that tended to, because a number of people in public health and in medicine, as well as some leaders in the gay community, felt that they were, you know, obviously places where you could spread the disease. And that the emergency measures needed to be taken to close them down. Well, very quickly, the debate became framed by other leaders in the gay community as a debate over civil rights, the people's rights to have businesses and things like that. And I think that got to the central problem that actually it's the same problem that I criticized the Reagan administration for. It's taking a health issue and framing it as a political issue. And that's where I think we've had so many problems, whether it's the Reagan administration framing AIDS funding issues in terms of its political priorities of holding the line on domestic spending, or whether it's the gay community framing AIDS prevention measures as civil liberties issues. I think it's wrong because you have to start dealing with this as a public health problem.
Mm-hmm. In the book, you talk about this man who researchers think may well be the person who introduced AIDS to North America, the man who has been designated Patient Zero.
Yeah.
And that's something that a lot of media, I think, picked up very quickly on in response to the book. And you, I'm sure that you got to know a lot about him. What I wonder is, I guess people reading it may find him difficult to understand. And I wonder if you feel that you do, and how it is that we are to really understand this man.
Well, let's first talk about his role in the epidemic that we know about scientifically. You've got to remember, back in late 1981, it was very unclear as to whether AIDS was a new infectious disease or whether it was caused by some environmental factor, perhaps some drug that people were taking that was making them lose their immune systems. Well, the key clue to this mystery came up in December of 1981 when a gay physician was talking to one of his patients in Los Angeles, and one of the patients mentioned that a number of the people who got AIDS in L.A. early on had been to bed together. Well, this piqued this doctor's curiosity. He called the Centers for Disease Control, and they dispatched investigators to Los Angeles and interviewed as many people who had AIDS as they could to find out who their sexual contacts were. And one name kept coming up again and again, and fortunately it was an unusual name, so it stuck in the investigators' minds. That name was Gaetan Dugas. Now, there's a constellation of unfortunate circumstances with Gaetan. That first, he was clearly one of the first gay men in North America to be infected with this virus. He had a voracious sexual appetite, and because he was very good-looking, he could fulfill that. And then also, being a flight attendant for Air Canada, he could fly all over the place for next to nothing, and that's what he did. By the time the researchers had finished their research, they found that 40 of the first 248 gay men who got AIDS in the United States either had sex with Gaetan or had had sex with somebody who did have sex with him. Now, this kind of clustering of cases among so many of the early AIDS cases was very powerful evidence that AIDS was an infectious disease. And it also gave a very powerful piece of evidence that AIDS was a sexually transmitted disease. So this was a very crucial point of understanding this disease.
Well, coming to where we are now, do you think that we are doing what we should and as much as we should now in dealing with AIDS?
Well, I think there's a couple components to our current fight against AIDS that you have to look at. One component is the scientific research, and that's, the research for a treatment and for a vaccine. Now, in terms of money, most scientists I've talked to believe that there is a lot of money now going into this fight, and that it's a reasonable amount of money. The problem is that there's still not an awful – it's the problem is still very political, that there's not an awful lot of leadership coming from the federal government, that there's still somewhat a business as usual attitude toward the development of drugs at the National Institutes of Health. There's the problems like they've got all the money they need, but there's a hiring freeze, and so the Office of Management and Budget, the way to currently frustrate AIDS research, is to simply refuse to let the National Institutes of Health hire anybody, and so that slowed down research a lot. And it's sad that we're having these bureaucratic problems, because researchers I know are getting increasingly optimistic about our chance to overcome those biological barriers to AIDS treatments and AIDS vaccines. But right now they're more concerned about the bureaucratic, the political barriers than the biological barriers, and that's very sad.
Mm-hmm. So
on the front of education and prevention, I mean, in lieu of a vaccine and in lieu of a treatment or cure right now, it becomes very crucial to have education and prevention to make sure that nobody gets infected with this virus. And that's where we're doing a real miserable job right now. I've traveled all over the world. And when I was in Denmark doing research for this book in 1985, mailmen were going to every house in the country dropping AIDS prevention brochures in the mailboxes. 2 weeks later, I went to Germany. They were doing the same thing. England has had a huge national campaign of AIDS prevention, where they use TV, billboards, everything to get the message out, don't die of ignorance. I was in Uganda a few months ago, and there you can't go to a gas station or a grocery store without seeing AIDS posters, and their president of Uganda in every rally talks about preventing, the need to prevent AIDS. And it's interesting that there's only one country right now in the Western world, the developed world, that has not had a national AIDS campaign, education campaign, and that country is the United States. What has happened is that we have people in the federal government, people like Surgeon General Koop, who would like to have a national education campaign. But the political leaders of this administration, and I think their spokesman has been Secretary of Education Bennett, have political objections to having a public health campaign. And that ideologically they want one that will reflect the point of view of their most far-right constituency, which is a constituency that says, no, you can't tell people how to have safe sex because they shouldn't be having sex at all. And so, again, I think what we're seeing is the same old problem. The band still plays on in this, that a public health issue, that of having AIDS prevention and education, is being framed as a political debate. And you've got to remember that the result has been not to have a national education campaign. But what we always have to remember with this is that the virus is moving even if the government is not. And time is always the great enemy in an epidemic. And once again, time is being allowed to win.
We're just about the place where we have to stop. We have about a minute. I was going to ask what was it you hoped to accomplish by writing the book, but I think maybe you've already answered the question.
Yeah, I just think that there's nothing about AIDS that the average person can't understand. I'm just a newspaper reporter from Aurora, Illinois, and if I can understand it, anybody can understand it. And it's some of the information is a little complicated, but it's not so much that the average person can't. And I think that's something, and I think a lot of the fear and misplaced panic around AIDS comes from just people not understanding it, because I'm Midwestern enough to believe that people are more good than evil, and that the problems we've had around AIDS result not from maliciousness, but just ignorance.
That is Randy Schiltz talking on Focus 580, that's what we called it then, December 8th of 1987. His book is And the Band Played On, Politics, People, and the AIDS Epidemic. The book was a big bestseller, which surprised everyone at the time, even the author. He also wrote about the experiences of gay men and lesbians in the military in his book Conduct Unbecoming. Randy Schiltz died of AIDS in 1994. He was 42. This is Focus. I'm David Hinge. This year, our program turns 30, and we are celebrating by bringing back some of the oldest interviews that we have in our archives. If you have some comments on this whole project or generally on the show, we'd certainly like to hear them. You can express them in a couple of ways. You can go to our website, which is will.illinois.edu. Go to the Focus section, and there at the top, you'll find a place that you can write to us. Or if you'd like to send a conventional letter or postcard, you can also do that. You can write to us at Campbell Hall, 300 North Goodwin Avenue in Urbana, and the zip code is 61801. Well, it's certainly been long argued that the way to deal with a public health problem like sexually transmitted disease is education, but that is complicated by the need to talk openly about what people do in the bedroom. Back in 1993, Joycelyn Elders became the first African American and only the second woman to serve as the United States Surgeon General. She was appointed to the post by then-President Bill Clinton and had held the job of director of the Arkansas Department of Public Health when Mr. Clinton was the governor. Her term as U.S. Surgeon General turned out to be brief. It was only a little more than a year. She was fired in December of 1994 after having made some very frank comments about masturbation. She was a guest on our show in November of 1996. We talked after the publication of her memoir, Joycelyn Elders, M.D., From Sharecropper's Daughter to Surgeon General of the United States of America. In that book, she explains that growing up, she never would have dreamed of being a doctor, but she did well in school, and she got a scholarship to Philander Smith College in Little Rock. And it was there that she heard a talk by a woman named Edith Jones. She was the first black graduate of the medical school at the University of Arkansas. Joycelyn Elders says that after that, she knew that she wanted a medical career.
Well, you know, I really thought that more than likely I might live the kind of parents life my parents did, but more important than that, I really almost got the impression that if I grew up and got to be a clerk in a grocery store or a dry goods store, that would have been my utopia.
Hmm. You did well enough in school, in grade school and high school, so that you a scholarship was available so that you could go to college. And
yes.
Perhaps if that had not been then, you probably wouldn't have been able to go to college.
No, I might still be down there on the farm. And I was just fortunate. The United Methodist Women offered the top student in the graduating class a tuition-paid scholarship to a Philander Smith College, which was an all-black college, but, you know, that was the only kind there were back then, to go to Philander Smith. And, you know, I didn't even know to apply. I didn't know to apply for dormitory rooms. Nobody in my family had ever gone to college. Things like indoor plumbing, you know, just ordinary things we all take for granted now. I'd never seen.
Yeah.
TV.
When you were growing up, the house you lived in had no indoor plumbing, had no electricity?
No indoor plumbing, no electricity. And you know, water, we had to really get, we had a well, which we used for water for washing dishes, but not for drinking water. We had to walk about a mile and a half to get catch water in jugs or buckets to bring home to use for drinking and cooking.
Tell me about this experience that you had when you were there and Edith Jones came and talked, and this was apparently what inspired you to want to be a doctor.
Well, colleges, you know, they have different organizations sponsor what we call chapel programs. I don't know whether people all ever have them, but at church schools you have what we call chapel programs. And so every Wednesday you had chapel, and you were allowed, they had different organizations could really recruit and bring in different speakers. We had our Pyramid Club, which is my sorority, had asked, I was not a member of the sorority at the time, had asked Dr. Jones to come in to speak. Well, she was a medical student at the time. And she came, and she, you know, this was a very petite, beautiful, beautiful black woman who got up, and she started talking about the difference between taking the high roads and the low, and kind of in between on the misty paths, the rest walked to and fro. And, you know, she built this to... And I was just absolutely mesmerized. And from that day on, all I could think of, I wanted to be just like her. I wanted to do everything I could to be just like Dr. Jones. And even though my teachers in Philander was telling me, well, you know, you better take some education, you better do this, because, well, you know, the only thing that we could look forward to then as black students was being a teacher or working at the post office.
So if the person who had given this talk had been in law school, do you think that you would be, just to pick one, would you be a lawyer today?
I mean, it's very possible. It's very possible. You know, but you see, I had never seen doctors or lawyers or anything. The first time I ever saw a doctor was when I was examined at that college for admission. I'd never seen a doctor before. And you just can't be what you can't see. And the only thing I'd seen before that I admired was the clerks at the department store.
So the first time that you'd ever had a physical or anything like that was when you were, 17 or 18 years old?
When I was 16
years old. 16
years old when you were... college.
Wow. Our guest this morning is Dr. Joycelyn Elders. She is former Surgeon General of the United States and currently spends her time speaking and also teaching. She's professor of pediatrics at the University of Arkansas Medical School and also has an autobiography, which recently has been published and is out now. So if you'd like to look at it, seek it out in the bookstores. The title of the book is Joycelyn Elders, M.D., From Sharecropper's Daughter to Surgeon General of the United States of America. It's published by William Morrill and Company. And, of course, questions are welcome. We do have someone calling in here, and we'll talk with them. And other people are welcome, too. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. I have a caller in Bloomington, I believe, and it's line 4. Hello.
Good morning, Dr. Elders.
Good morning. How are you?
I would like to ask you to cast your mind back to that crucial news conference that you held that led to your leaving your post as in the government.
Right.
The reporter that asked you that significant question.
Yes, sir.
Who was he, and do you think, as I do, that he deliberately set you up?
Well, you know, the person that asked me that question was a psychiatrist. And I really don't. In fact, I've even gotten a letter from him. I really think that he was asking an honest question about, there were about 30 African countries there. And we know that, they have a very, very high percentage of HIV disease.
Yes.
And their health minister was there. And I was just thinking that he was talking about alternative means of sexual expression.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and what I would, and he asked me if I thought that, that this was a possibility. And I said that I felt that masturbation was a normal part of human sexuality.
Yes, I remember.
And that we should stop lying to children, saying hair is going to grow on their hands, they're going to go blind, they're going to go crazy. So I did not think it was a setup. It may have been, but I never thought so.
Uh-huh. I see. Then he was not a reporter, is that correct?
No, that was not a reporter. And, you know, it was this was held at the UN. There were, I bet, 30 or 40 reporters from all over the country there. Not a single one even mentioned that for 9 days. And the reason why it was mentioned then is that the reporter from U.S. News and World Report who wrote the article, he flew to New York with me because he wanted an interview, and I got him into the UN. I got him into the luncheon, and, you know, he was just with me. He was considered my guest. And then when we were on our way back, he asked me about, he said, well, Dr. Elders, what did you think about that question, about masturbation? And I said, well, I thought I gave an honest and true answer. So what he said in his article, that he thought that I would cause a Democrat some problems because whenever I was asked a question, I would answer it openly and honestly.
Yes. Well, thank you very much, Dr.
Thank you.
I greatly appreciate you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Well,
what,
for calling in.
What do you think, though, Bill Clinton must have known the kind of person that you were from the experience of having you head the Department of Public, State Health Department in Arkansas, and knew the kind of views you had and the fact that you didn't hesitate, as you say, to, if someone asks you a question, you're going to give them a straight answer.
Yes.
It couldn't have surprised the president that that's the kind of person you were. Why do you think it was, though, that after this, I guess it must have been the proverbial last straw, and they said to themselves, well, we got to let Joycelyn go. Why do you think that, though, that was, that they'd ask you to resign?
Well, I really think that probably the president felt that, you know, there was, you know, after the November elections, and this was at the low point in his presidency. He was really, I think, feeling that, you know, the country was really wanting to go a different way and wanted a different tact, and that he just felt that, and then I had really become the, if you will, what the, that, you know, the Christian right and certain members of the Congress was using for target practice. And about every other week they was bringing up a bill being sponsored to get rid of me. So I think he just felt it was probably far easier to let me go, and that would be one less problem he would have to deal with.
Do you feel, I know that you don't, apparently you don't feel animosity. Do you feel, well, sort of disappointed in a way that perhaps the president didn't support you a little bit more?
Well, you know, I went to Washington to be the Surgeon General. I went there to do the job. I didn't go there to get the job. And I did the very best job I knew how to do. And, you know, if that was not what the president wanted, well, then I feel that the president has to do what he feels he had to do. And I want you to know that if I had it all to do over again, starting today, knowing everything that I know now, I would still do it the same way. I was about trying to make a difference for young people in this country and trying to improve, you know, the health and well-being, reduce AIDS, teenage pregnancy, drug addiction. That's what I was about, and that's what I'm still about, and I felt that I was approaching it in the only way that I knew how, and nobody has proposed anything better to me yet.
Yeah. I think it's interesting to look at how the position of the Surgeon General has changed over the past, a couple of decades, or maybe even not quite that long, and I think perhaps the person who had the most had the biggest role in making that change was your predecessor, Dr. Koop.
Yeah, well, he wasn't my immediate predecessor, even we had a Surgeon General in between.
Oh, Dr. Novella, indeed. The two of them, they really have changed.
I agree with you.
Yeah, it has gone from being a position that was something of a figurehead to one where those people who've held the position have felt that it presented them with an opportunity to speak out on issues of public health, very
Absolutely.
Big ones, and in that way that it has raised the importance of that position to a level that before Dr. Koop came along, It just didn't have.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, years ago it used to have a very high-level position, and then it really got cut down to a lower-level position and combined with being the Assistant Secretary of Health. And so I think, you know, we had a lot of good Assistant Secretaries of Health that, you know, like Dr. Julius Richman was very, very important in really getting Head Start on its way, you know, and pulling that out. And then, you know, Dr. Luther Perry was the first person to come out and say that cigarettes cause cancer. And then another Surgeon General was fired for saying the word syphilis.
Hmm. I want to return for a little bit to the topic of teen sexuality, something that I know that you're very concerned with. And it seems that as a society that we face something of the same difficulty that as parents we also face, and that is trying to resolve this dilemma where on the one hand the message that we want to give to the children is please wait.
Yes.
Everybody wants to give that message, obviously. But then, on the other hand, you know, sort of in the back of your mind, you're thinking, well, you know, they might not wait, and if they don't, then what we want to do is to try as best we can to have them protected against sexually transmitted disease, and also, we don't want girls getting pregnant.
Right.
So here, and parents, I think, are often faced with this dilemma. They say, now, if I'm trying to give these two messages, and particularly if I say, don't do it, but if you're going to do it, protect yourself, that somehow that blunts the force of the don't do it message. And so, you know, we kind of go back and forth about how do you try to communicate both of those messages at the same time, and whether it's indeed possible to do that, or whether, you know, parents fear that they're somehow, by telling their kids about birth control, that they're giving them license to be sexually active before they really should be. So how do we do that? How do we balance,
you know,
those two things?
We don't. None of us know how to do that. But I think the important thing that we need to know, first of all, is that the worst message that we can give our children is no message. That is, you know, we don't give them all the facts. And then to give them wrong messages, lies. You know, I feel that we should tell them the truth regardless of how painful. Thirdly, I think that we as parents, you know, you start from birth having children understand how you feel, having them understand and appreciate your values and what you stand for and what you want and what you expect. And, you know, and you build that. That's ingrained. That becomes a part of them. By the same token, they know that when you're teaching them, telling them, you know, about contraceptives, about things of this sort, that what you're really, they will perceive that what you're really doing is giving them all of the information. And many times, you know, they'll say, oh, Dad, I don't need that, or you don't need to tell me about that. But then by the same token, they feel, well, you know, my dad wants me to always be protected, but he knows I would not do anything like that, and I would never do anything like that to hurt my dad. But, you know, when we don't sit around and don't say anything or just tell them no, well, children, they rebel against that. So I think, the more young people know, the better they respond and the more likely they are to be responsible. So what we do is we sit around and try and legislate morals and trying to prevent sex. Well, what we really need to be doing is trying to teach young people how to be responsible and trying to teach them preventing disease and preventing unplanned, unwanted pregnancies.
We have someone here in Normal, in line one. Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
Dr. Elders, very nice to speak with you. I'm a former four-year veteran of World War II, also an educator, and I wanted to ask you what your feelings were or are regarding the congressional failure to pass a national health care system during the president's first term.
Well, you know, I really very strongly feel that every American should have a right to health care. We feel that every criminal has a right to a lawyer, so every citizen should have a right to health care. I think that part of the problem is we got involved with partisan politics We didn't get everybody on board that needed to be on board, you know, and I think the medical profession, the hospital association, and many of the others, you know, did not come on board. So I feel that we need to go back to the table, get all of the players involved, let them fight till they're bloody, and we need to develop a sound health care system for this country.
It seems to me that one of the difficulties, may be the big difficulty of approaching health care reform, is that for different groups of people, the issues are a little bit different.
You're absolutely right.
That is, you know, for poor people, it's kind of one issue. For working poor, it's something else. For middle class, it's something else. There's the issue of long-term care. And,
right.
And then perhaps overall the issue of cost and trying to contain cost, is it really possible to somehow develop a plan as the Clinton administration tried to do that would somehow take care of all of these programs,
you know,
under one?
I think you're right. First, I think we have to really look at what we're trying to do. If you're talking about, you know, let's say an acute health care system, actually we've got a pretty good acute health care system in this country. But if you're talking about primary preventive health, the community health, it's terrible. The infrastructure is rotten. We don't have any leadership. And that's what we really need. And that's what we're going to have to do to really bring down costs. If you think about it, actually about 37% of our, you know, a significant percent of our country have Medicare, a significant percent have Medicaid, and the rest, another percent have private insurance, and only about 14 or 15% that don't have any insurance. And nobody has long-term care. You know, nobody really pays for that,
yeah,
except Medicaid. And that's because people make sure that their parents get poor enough so they can get them on Medicaid to take care of long-term care in nursing homes. And then that means the government takes care of it. But I really think that we need to look at the various sections separately, evaluate them, and carefully scrutinize them and decide what is it that we need to do. Because, you know, we can say, well, we don't do long-term care, but in fact, the government already pays for long-term care. 64% of the people in nursing homes, the government pays for them.
And that is Joycelyn Elders. She's the former Surgeon General of the United States. She was a guest on our program. Back then we called it Focus 580, in November of 1996. In 1993, she became the first African American and only the second woman to serve as the U.S. Surgeon General. She is today Professor Emeritus at the University of Arkansas School of Medicine. She continues to be very outspoken on matters of public health. Back when we talked in 1996, it was just after the publication of her memoir, Joycelyn Elders, M.D., From Sharecropper's Daughter to Surgeon General of the United States of America. Well, this is Focus. This year, we are celebrating our 30th anniversary, and one thing that we thought it might be interesting to do would be to go back and dig into our tape archive, look at some of the oldest interviews that we have. These are programs that, in many cases, have not been heard since they were first broadcast, and bring some of those back. And we're doing it a couple of times a month, and we'll do it again in a couple of weeks. In the meantime, we'd certainly like to have any comments you have on this project or generally on the show. Maybe there is some particular guest or topic that stands out in your mind as you think back to some of the shows we've done over the last 30 years or so. And if you have comments, we'd certainly like to hear them. You can go to our website, which is WILL.illinois.edu. Go to the Focus section, and at the top that you'll find a place where you can write in. If you'd like to send a postcard or a letter in the conventional way, you can certainly also write us at Campbell Hall, and we are at 300 North Goodwin Avenue in Urbana, Illinois, and the zip is 61801.